The feats of creative people are a wonder to people who do not consider themselves creative. I mean, what does go on in the mind of a Pablo Picasso or a David Bowie? We actually have some answers for that about what sorts of brain processes and structures lead to creativity, and they are summarized in the book Wired to Create, Unraveling the Mysteries of the Creative Mind. Scott Barry Kaufman is one of the writers with Carolyn Gregoire. Scott got his degree in cognitive psychology from Yale. He's now the University of Pennsylvania's Positive Psychology Center. He's there, where he leads the Science of Imagination Project. In addition to writing or editing half a dozen other books and hosting podcasts, Scott writes the Beautiful Minds blog for Scientific American. Carolyn Gregoire is a senior writer on psychology, neuroscience, and mental health for the Huffington Post. She appears on broadcast for HuffPo and has appeared on MSNBC and The Today Show, among others. Welcome, Carolyn.
Thank you.
And welcome, Scott.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. Good to have you here. And Scott, let's start with you. What is positive psychology at this Center for Positive Psychology?
Oh, thanks for asking that question. A lot of people who interview me about creativity don't necessarily ask that question, but it's so linked to creativity, so I really appreciate that. Positive psychology is the scientific study of human flourishing and what it means to live a good life.
Okay, so focusing on the things that can actually make your life nice and fun. And
yeah, the things that are going well in your life. I mean, psychology has focused so many years on what's wrong with people, you know, anxiety, you know, and curing anxiety, curing depression, curing other mental illnesses only gets you to about, you know, zero. It doesn't get you to like plus 50. It doesn't make you necessarily enjoy your experiences in life. And positive psychology studies all the topics that are meaningful to people's lives, such as social relationships and compassion and personal and purpose and meaning and engagement in our work and our families.
Is the search for creativity, Scott, then just to know where it comes from or perhaps to spur it in others?
Sorry, what do you mean?
Is the search for creativity about knowing where creativity comes from in the brain or about spurring it in others or maybe all of the above?
I think all the above. You know, we can study creativity from lots of different vantage points, and I think that's, you know, we're not, as scientists, we're not bound to a particular perspective. I like to study it from the point of view of the person. I also like to study it from the point of view of the environment. I think all these things are constantly interacting with each other. I mean, our environment does a good job suppressing creativity, I would say, in lots of different contexts, but it also has the amazing possibilities to increase creativity.
Suppressing creativity how?
By really taking away opportunities and all sorts of different ways that people can increase creativity. I mean, in the schools, we do standardized testing, and we do all sorts of things that really send the message to students that we don't care about creativity. We don't care about people who have new ideas or challenge assumptions. They're often treated, actually, as troublemakers.
The creative kids are.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Carolyn, you're right that there's been quite a bit of polarization over creativity among scientists. Would you tease that out a bit for us?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is kind of a historical progression, really. Before the 1950s, the commonly held view in psychology was that creativity was kind of, or the creative process was a very linear one, and that, you know, there was a four-stage model of the creative process that was, you know, took the idea from first coming into consciousness to being verified and made useful to society. But we realize that creativity is so much more complicated than that. It's not a linear process, and it's not just intelligence either. That was another sort of misconception that scientists had for a long time. But in fact, creativity is so much more complex, and it involves just a huge host of emotions and cognitive styles and psychological strengths and experiences that all come together. And when people are creating, it tends to be more of a process of blind experimentation and of back and forth than a simple step-by-step, you know, you get the idea and then you flush it out and then you make it useful and then you finalize the product. It's really not like that at all. So the polarization was, you know, between these two ideas of creativity, one that's quite simplified and one that's much more complex.
Are creative people then risk takers in the context you just mentioned, where they'll try things out? And I mean, they're not afraid to look at things and come up with ideas that will fail, it sounds like.
Absolutely, yeah. And they're one of the most defining characteristics of creative people is that they are risk takers, and they become comfortable with failure, because to create and to really do something innovative, it just it necessitates that risk. Not everyone's going to like it, but in order to move a field forward or to move anything forward, you know, the idea has to be bold. And so we, you know, we find that creative people become very comfortable with failure. And really creativity we talk about as being a numbers game. You know, Shakespeare created some really bad plays and we don't really talk about that, but it's because his body of work was so huge that he was constantly iterating, and, you know, the bad plays could be seen as a stepping stone to the good ones. And that doesn't necessarily mean that it was a linear move from the ones that were not as successful to the ones that were. But in so many creative people's lives, we see a lot of failure, and ultimately that failure is a part of the success.
So while we're learning in the book that creativity is messy, Scott, does that mean the search for the sources of creativity within the brain is similarly messy?
Yeah, it's messy in the sense of the methods that we use in science to study it are still nascent, and we're still developing better techniques. But also when we look at people's brains, we see that people who are really good at coming up with imaginative ideas, who are really good at coming up with multiple possibilities, something such as how many uses are there for a brick, or how many uses are there for a paperclip, they're really good at switching between seemingly incompatible brain networks. So in most people, these two brain networks, so what's called the executive attention brain network, where we focus on the outside world, and the default mode network, or what we call it the imagination network, which is highly active when we're daydreaming, are kind of at odds with each other. So the more we focus on the outside world, the more our imagination is suppressed. The more that we have this, we dip into our inner storehouse of knowledge and memories and daydreams, the more the executive attention network is suppressed. But with creative people, they have shorter pathways between these brain networks, which means that they can access these two modes of thought much more flexibly.
Okay, so a combination of things going on to lead to creativity. The book is called Wired to Create, Unraveling the Mysteries of the Creative Mind. We'll come back and talk more with its authors on the Jefferson Exchange in 1 minute. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of JPR, I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are talking about the book Wired to Create, Unraveling the Mysteries of the Creative Mind, with authors Scott Barry Kaufman, a psychologist at the University of Pennsylvania, and Carolyn Gregoire, who writes about psychology and neuroscience for the Huffington Post. 800-838-3760 if you'd like to join us, jx@jeffnet.org by email. Scott, I'm almost afraid to ask, have we gotten to the point where we can say, based on some measurements, this person is creative and this one is not?
Yeah, we can. Not in a foolproof way, and we have to be very careful about when we measure anything in one slice of time about predicting their future. You know, that's why we have to be careful about the use of IQ tests. But if we use lots of different metrics and we try to combine them all, we get some sort of picture of what people are capable of creatively. For instance, like that test, how many that measures domain general creativity, like what would happen if you became invisible at will, and then you have to list all the possibilities. That tends to correlate with creative achievement. It tends to correlate with creative identity, the extent to which you have this, you include creativity as part of your identity, and lots of other metrics. All these metrics of creativity tend to intercorrelate with each other, which just means that they are seeming to be tapping into something.
The old left brain, right brain thing, though, is that generally untrue? There is no particular home in the brain for creativity?
You know, it depends on the stage of the creative process. It's way too simplistic to say that creativity is just a right brain phenomenon, because in most of us, we're, you know, the left brain and the left hemisphere and the right hemisphere are constantly communicating with each other. And like I said, these brain networks, that's a much better way to think of it. So lots of different brain areas get recruited to be kind of like team players of a network to process something. So it really does depend on the stage of the process. With that said, there are some forms of creativity, some forms of nonverbal, artistic forms that you may see greater activations in the right brain than the left brain. But for the whole creative process, to have novelty as well as usefulness, you're going to have to be communicating back and forth.
What do we know about the stimulation of creativity, exposing things to kids, for example, that make brain connections that could lead to creativity either then or later in life?
Like physical, like TDSC, electrical current?
No, I'm talking about just exposing them to...
That is a new field.
Really?
Investigation.
Okay, well, let's go there then. We'll come back to my part.
I was like, why just children? Why do you just want to zap the children? No. Because there is this emerging field of investigation where it's actually harmless, so I should say that right off the bat. You can shut off parts of the brain, and researchers are using this form of technology. It's this transcranial current. To shut off certain parts of the brain that we know might get in the way of insights.
Interesting.
And they are finding, you know, significant results that it is the case. Some even argue that someday we'll have a thinking cap where we'll, like, put it on our heads and allow us to stimulate ideas.
Wow, physically. Something that really will give you a little zap and push in the right direction. There was a time I got an electric shock and I remembered my ATM code at that very moment.
Oh, that's interesting. That's something.
I'll write it up sometime. Okay, so back to my original question, though, which was about the kinds of things that you might want to expose kids to. I mean, everything from, I don't know, baby Mozart to woodworking, something that would encourage them to make the brain connections that lead to creativity.
I think that's a really good question, an important one. And it's not like you have to have kids listen to Mozart or start painting when they're 3 years old. In the book, we talk about the fact that children are sort of natural creators and that really comes out during play. And so the most important thing is really giving children the opportunity to play, which is increasingly something that we don't do. I mean, children's playtime has decreased something like 25% since the 70s. And so I think where, you know, we see things that are really stimulating children's creativity are places like in Switzerland. They have a thing called forest kindergartens where children for an entire kindergarten year are outside exploring and playing and building and, you know, just exercising that natural creativity. And it really, it's really building important cognitive and emotional and social skills. So that's the most important thing.
We're talking to Carolyn Gregoire and Scott Barry Kaufman about their book, Wired to Create, Unraveling the Mysteries of the Creative Mind, here on the Jefferson Exchange. And in fact, when you were talking about the programs that stimulate kids' minds, you have a bit of a bone to pick in here for our screen-centric society. What's the damage you see that doing to kids?
Well, it's not just kids, but really all of us, I think. You know, screens are infiltrating pretty much every aspect of our lives and making it much more difficult to sustain our focus on any task. And to do creative work, we have to be able to sit down and think deeply and focus for an extended period on what we're doing. Otherwise, you know, we're stuck in kind of the shallow part of the mind when we're constantly being distracted by our phones, by notifications, by email. So it's kind of a threat to all of our creativity, not just children, although children are certainly at risk too. But I think it's something that we all need to be aware of. And, you know, setting kind of limits for ourselves on our screen time is crucial if we're going to be able to sit down and write a play or paint something or think of a new idea for work. Any sort of exercise that requires creativity requires deep thinking and focus.
I sense a parallel to sleep in the sense that if you keep interrupting your sleep, you're not going to be able to get deep into your sleep. But likewise, if you keep interrupting your wakefulness, you're not going to be able to keep yourself focused on one thought for a long time.
Absolutely. And I think Nicholas Carr, who wrote The Shallows, did a really great job of looking at how heavy technology use is affecting the brain and keeping us on that very shallow level of thought. It's just, you know, it's impossible to really tap into a deeply creative mindset when you're only giving yourself little snippets of moments to focus on what you need to do.
Carolyn, talk about the initial contact where you came across Scott's research and published a piece in the Huffington Post.
So I originally reached out to Scott because I came across his research on daydreaming, which is a big part of the book as well. And I wrote an article about all of the amazing stuff Scott's doing around the importance of mind wandering and why it's so critical for creative incubation, for the development of compassion and morality and all of these really important traits. So we worked together on that, and then I was fascinated by his research on creativity. So we worked together on another piece, this one about creativity, and it went viral, and it really seemed to resonate with a lot of creative people who saw themselves in the description that we made together of the creative mind. So that was where this book came from.
Now, there were like 18 things in the article and 10 things in the book that highly creative people do differently. What happened to the other eight?
Well, those are still important, but we distilled it down to the most essential elements. And in the article, there were things like people watching, which is fun, but we didn't need to do a whole chapter on people watching. We do have a chapter on mindfulness where we talk about that, but we incorporate other sort of aspects of mindfulness as well.
So before we embark on the 10, is this advice, Scott, to do what people do when they're creative?
Is there advice? Do we give advice in the book? Is that what you're saying?
Well, I mean, is this advice to just do what they do, or is this just a description of what they do?
I see what you're saying. We say these are habits that creative people do, and I think there are things that we, these are things that we can all do, absolutely, yeah.
All right, I don't know if we'll get to them all, but let me list them up front. Imaginative play, passion, daydreaming, solitude, intuition, openness to experience, mindfulness, sensitivity, turning adversity into advantage, and number 10, thinking differently. So in imaginative play, Carolyn, how is Shigeru Miyamoto a good example of imaginative play?
So he is a video game designer from Japan, the main designer of all of the big Nintendo games. And he is such a great example of play, I think, because he was such an imaginative person as a young child, and he kept that sense of play into adulthood. So he talks about his childhood in rural Japan, where he was making puppets, and he was outside kind of like exploring caves and inventing imaginary worlds in his mind. And that really deeply informed the games that he later created. Some of them were actually based on his childhood imaginings. But more fundamentally, he sort of maintained a sense of play that he brought to his work, and that's why people love his games so much, is that they're fun. And he had a good time when he was making them, and he had such a playfulness in putting together different elements into his games, and that totally comes across to anyone who plays them. So it's really that trajectory we talk about in a lot of creative people, from pretend play in childhood up to maintaining a sense of play in their creative work as adults.
Carolyn Gregoire of the Huffington Post and Scott Barry Kaufman of the University of Pennsylvania are the co-authors of Wired to Create, Unraveling the Mysteries of the Creative Mind, here on the Jefferson Exchange. 800-838-3760 if you'd like to join the discussion by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. So in imaginative play, if adults want to keep or restore a sense of imaginative play, I mean, what kinds of tips can you give them to get past the feeling feeling like they're feeling silly or something?
There's nothing wrong with being silly. First, you need to like recognize that it's okay to take lots of different ideas and mix and match them in funny, interesting ways. I think that like kind of first I would say take like an improv class. It's amazing to me when I took that course in New York on improv, and it was amazing to me how relevant that is to our everyday lives. How relevant it is to truly listen. It helps increase our ability to truly listen to others. It increases our ability to think of alternate perspectives. All these things are really important. That kind of mindset. If we're ever in a point in our life where we have a job and we feel like all we're doing all day long is working, that and it's not play at all. I mean, we really should sit back and maybe go through some of the meditative practices we talk about in the book, or solitude and really get in touch with your inner self again, because that inner self is there's a great amount of play that is buried deep down there that we don't access as adults.
I hear you on improv. There's a lot about collaboration there, saying yes and taking the other person's pitch and expanding upon it rather than going, no, I like this idea better, which is
exactly
what often
right.
happens in the workplace.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
So let's see, passion is the second traits of the people who are very creative. You bring up examples like Yo-Yo Ma and others. There are two kinds of passion, though, harmonious and expressive. How are they different?
Oh, yeah. It's actually obsessive. But expressive would be really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So harmonious passion is when we have an activity that's well integrated into the core of our identity in a way that we feel good about ourselves when we're engaged in something. It's in line with our other values, and it's not based on any contingencies such as self-esteem or money or other external contingencies. Whereas obsessive passion is we really are influenced by all these contingencies. Like if I don't do well, you know, my ego is tied up to it. I'm really going to not feel good about myself, or if I don't do well, I won't ever, you know, win that award or make that money. And harmonious passion has been correlated with lots of important elements that are that in themselves correlate with creativity, such as inspiration, vitality, you know, like feeling alive in life, gratitude, and lots of other things that we study in positive psychology.
Obsessive, not expressive. You know, sorry about that.
Oh, no problem. That was creative.
There's a section here in the chapter on passion about hopes and dreams. Which raises the question: do you have to be optimistic to be creative?
That's a good question. I think not necessarily overly optimistic. It has more to do with sort of having a vision for yourself. We talk about the idea of falling in love with a dream, which is something that a lot of creative people do. And this comes from E. Paul Torrens, this famous psychologist who studied creativity for decades. And he talks about creative people sort of falling in love with a future vision of themselves and then doing the hard work necessary to see that through. So I think to some extent we do need the optimism to believe in that vision of the future, but it's not necessarily sort of seeing everything through rose-colored lenses. It's really just having a clear sense of what is the most important thing to you, what is the activity that you love more than anything else, and then doing what you have to do to make that a reality.
And we already mentioned daydreaming just in passing. And it sounds like, Scott, there's been quite a fight among psychologists about the value of daydreaming over the centuries.
Yeah, and it's depicted in how the scientist refers to the phenomenon. So if you read a paper and they use the word mind-wandering, you know right away they don't like daydreaming. but if you read a paper and you actually use the phrase daydreaming, it's more likely that they're actually talking about something positive. Yeah, there is kind of a war, but it really comes down to, at the end of the day, like how... What measures are the researchers looking at? So the researchers who look at the cost of mind wandering tend to look at things like SAT reading comprehension performance and IQ and other forms of things. Where yeah, it's true. Like if you're just daydreaming all day long, like you're gonna not probably do that well on all those kinds of things. But then those who study daydreaming study other kinds of metrics like creativity and reflection, what's called constructive internal reflection, which can be really an important source of insight, self-insight. So it really depends on the measures. There's no ultimately good or bad. There are trade-offs, which is why we argue in this book for the middle way.
We're talking about the book Wired to Create, Unraveling the Mysteries of the Creative Mind. Stephen Medford writes, there's anecdotal evidence that the incidence of depression in creative persons is leaps and bounds beyond that of the general population, leading some people to speculate that there might be a brain function link between a highly creative personality and susceptibility to depression. Is there any hard evidence for this? That'd be on you, Scott.
Okay, sure. So the depression one is not... it hasn't been shown to be a positive link there. But in terms of hypomania, which is part of the bipolar cycle, there is research showing that hypomania can be positively related to idea generation, like your ability to come up with lots of different ideas. And also schizophrenia, the full-blown schizophrenia, is not conducive to creativity. However, some milder forms like schizotypia, which we all have in the population, which is proneness to fantasy, is correlated with creativity. So I should say that mental illness is not necessary nor sufficient for creativity, but there does to be some overlap between some of the processes associated with the two.
That would seem intuitively to make a certain amount of sense. I mean, anybody who's going to really pull things out of themselves that the rest of the world has never seen to create a new idea under the sun has to be willing to go to some lengths that some minds wouldn't go.
Yeah, you're exactly right. I mean, the thing that is very similar about people with schizophrenia and people with creativity is they're both people who are highly creative, is that they're both they dare to go to worlds that aren't based in reality. But the difference is that people who really have debilitating illnesses don't have the ability to then snap back to reality, whereas creative people can use their other functions, like we talk about in the book, like mindfulness and consciousness and rational thought, to then sort out the ideas that should be developed further from those that probably are just too crazy.
Mm-hmm. Which brings us to, I'm going to skip a couple ahead here to number six on the list, which is openness to experience. I mean, this is really, really a key here, it would seem, that people need to be able to absorb the stuff they see in the world and not just discard it as like an annoyance or something.
Yeah, openness to experience is the number one predictor of creativity in both art and science. And so part of that is being, you know, as the name suggests, open to new experiences in your life, but it's also, it goes far beyond that. Openness to experience encompasses intellectual curiosity, engagement with art and music. People who are really open to experiences tend to seek out new types of art and new film, new music, and also openness to your own inner life. So we can easily see how that would lead to creativity. So many artists and writers are very tapped into their own sort of internal monologue and their own emotions, which really informs their work. We think that openness to experience is something that anyone can really cultivate by just getting into that spirit of seeking out what's new, what's exciting, what's novel.
Well, we certainly learned a lot about creativity in the book Wired to Create, Unraveling the Mysteries of the Creative Mind. Carolyn Gregoire from the Huffington Post and Scott Barry Kaufman from the University of Pennsylvania wrote it and joined us today in the exchange. Thank you both for being here today.
Oh, thank you
so much for having us.
You bet.